Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, Veronica Bennett, as she was when she first entered my life as a member of the Ronettes, and subsequently, obviously, Ronnie Spector, no longer with us, which caused me to go. I sent a golf cart down the far end of the record collection, and I was actually amazed at
groaning it. With the produce.
No, it's amazing. I it's so long since I'd played this. I'd forgotten I have the first Ronettes album. I have it from when it was reissued in the 70s.
And has a great title, doesn't it? Presenting the Fabulous Ronettes featuring Veronica.
Featuring Veronica, yes. Yeah. No, at the point I got it, it was called Ronettes Sing Their Greatest Hits because it was 70s reissue. But it's the same album. And Sleeve Notes by Roy Carr. And pointing out how fortunate you are to be able to hear this because this had been completely off the market for years. And it's a reminder that there was a time, you know, in the 60s and 70s, when if a record was deleted, it didn't reappear.
Yeah.
Every
track is fantastic, isn't it?
It's absolutely
got What I'd Say by Ray Charles on there. Best part of Breaking Up, Chapel of Love.
It starts with, it starts with Walking in the Rain, which is just, it starts with a clap of thunder. I want to make 2 points here. Can I make 2 points?
Yeah, go on.
There's two ways of talking about genius. And the most common one is people apply it to individuals, you know, so-and-so's a genius. But actually, the other way of doing it is genius is a thing that occurs. It's a thing that occurs at certain points of time with certain combinations of people and circumstances. And the whole kind of Ronettes thing is an absolute classic case of the latter. Because what you've got working here is not just Ronnie Spector. You've also got the two other Ronettes, Nedra and Estelle. And you've got loads and loads of musicians. You've got the Wrecking Crew. You've got Hal Blaine. You've got Tommy Tedesco. You've got Carole Kaye. You've got Leon Russell. You've got Ray Pulman. You've got all these people. You've got Phil Spector, you've got Phil Spector's engineer. You've got the songwriters who supplied these bullets on this record. You know, the likes of Ellie Greenwich and Barry Mann and Cynthia Wilder and Vinnie Poncia and all these people. So nothing points out more eloquently the fact that pop music is a collaborative process than, you know, what came out on these records. And the other thing is, it's just the nature of listening to this record. And I listened to it a bunch of times yesterday. And God, it sounds fantastic. And what strikes you is this is pop music before the pill. This is pop music grounded in an era when the only way you got out the family home was by marrying somebody.
Yeah.
there was no period of independence and being full of St. Francis Free in between. You did one thing and then you did the other. And particularly if you came from slightly, you know, less privileged backgrounds and so forth. And so what's wonderful about this record is it's entirely about the dream of being in love, of wanting to be in love and wanting everything that seemed to come with it. And it starts Walking in the Rain with the clap of thunder. And you can't help thinking, technically, how difficult was it to synchronize a clap of thunder with a music track in 1963? Must have been really, really hard. There was no technology, no technology to do that kind of thing. You know, they did it by trial and error. Anyway, the opening line of Walking in the Rain is, I want him, I need him, and someday I'll meet him. So he hasn't actually met him at this point.
It's fantastic. It's a fantasy, isn't it?
Yeah. He'll be kind of shy and real good looking too. But I know that he'll be my guy for the things he'll like to do, like walking in the rain. And the whole thing comes in behind you. And it's just, it's a dream. It's a fantasy of being in love. That was what was so powerful about it. And let's not forget, and this is something people look down their nose at nowadays. You know, Phil Spector did say there were little symphonies for the kids. And if you go and listen to this record, and I cannot urge you too strongly, you know, you can find it, stream it, Spotify, it's there, all those places. Go and listen to the whole thing in sequence. It's just absolutely extraordinary. This is addressed to 13-year-old girls. That's what it's about. It's not adults, you know. It's completely the world of early teenagers, probably more girls than boys. It's promoting this really attractive fantasy that you could, you know, you're going to meet this guy and it's going to be absolutely wonderful. And he's going to kiss you, and suddenly the world is going to be utterly transformed. And then you're going to fantasize about being married and going off together. And there's actually a song two songs later is So Young. You know, they say we're so young, you know, we're so young, can't marry no one. Just absolutely extraordinary.
What a kind of irony that the man she did marry turned out to be Phil Spector.
Well, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it is, this record just throbs all the way through with the emotional energy of 13, 14, 15-year-olds just wanting life to be utterly transformed by romance. You know, it even finishes with Chapel of Love.
Yes.
Going to the chapel, we're going to get married, you know.
Yeah.
It swells and it throbs absolutely all the way through. And she has a voice that sounded like herself, but also sounded like every girl. And it's a voice a little bit like, you know, Lou Adler said of Carole King, she has a voice that all women like to think they have.
That's right.
And I think that's a really important part of it. It's not an Adele voice. It's not a Aretha Franklin
voice.
No, it's
not theatrical. It's conversational and you can join in completely. The other interesting thing about it is you listen to those arrangements, you know, and the kind of bombast that's going on all around, you know, the noise, the drum sound, the symphonies, you know, and she still cuts through. She's not drowned out.
Absolutely. Oh, listen, that's the genius of the whole thing, is that I can't remember, is it Baby I Love You or whatever, that you've got this kind of amorphous noise. You can't work out what it all is. It is that drums, is that bass, is that piano or whatever. And except over the top of it, you hear castanets really clearly.
Yeah.
The rhythm is dictated by castanets. The sense of drama, the sense of scale, but also intimacy.
And of deep,
about the thing.
On Be My Baby, you listen to, there's a drum snare, which I notice is a crack, and then there's a triple crack, and then a single crack, and a triple crack, all the way through the opening section. It's absolutely mesmerizing.
It's Hal Blaine.
Oh, it's phenomenal. I was read quite a lot of those obituaries, and if there's one moment in it that pointed out the kind of world that she was in, it's the bit where her mum gives her a load of tissue paper to stuff into her bra to make her look over the legal age to be able to get a job dancing in a mob-owned club. And you think, I've got it now. I've got the world that she's coming from. That is tough.
Yeah, but that record, and I have to say, I'd forgotten I'd got this, and I played it a bunch of times yesterday. This is this whole LP, and it's kind of odd because Spector used to say, oh, you know, LPs are a few hits and then a load of filler.
Yeah,
this is not.
No, every track,
you know, it's got Be My Baby, it's got Baby I Love You, it's got the best part of Breaking Up.
Yeah,
the best part of Breaking Up is when they're making up. You know, it's the masterwork of loads and loads of people, and one of them was Ronnie Spector.
The Word Podcast: prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So you know, the long winter nights. My wife and I the other day going through the cupboard and dug out old films, and we rewatched. And we haven't seen it for years, and I cannot recommend it more vigorously, and that is The Day of the Jackal with James Fox. And I was talking to you about it yesterday, and you've recently read the book? You've got the book there?
I've got the book here. The book is rarely far away from me, actually, and I just looked. This is a 1973 copy, price 50p. So this was, would have been probably before the film, I would have thought. The film would have been, came out.
It was.
Slightly
it
after was. That. Because yeah. the book was published in 1971. You know the story of how he wrote it?
No, go on.
He was Frederick Forsyth, he was a reporter, Daily Express reporter, and did a lot of foreign stories, and just wanted to write a bestseller to make a load of money. And so just sat down pretty much in a hotel room for about 6 months and wrote a bestseller. And it's been a bestseller absolutely ever since. And it is,
phenomenal.
The acme of the airport novel. If you've never read it, I feel sorry for you if you've never read it. Correct that situation as soon as possible.
And if you've not seen the film, or you have, go back and see it again. Because, I mean, it is quite long, and you cannot believe that it sustains throughout. There's not a moment that doesn't have incredible tension. B, what an extraordinary idea that, you know, it's based on an assassination attempt on de Gaulle. And we know in real life that never happened.
There were attempts.
Based on a real event, yeah. You know, but we know it's going to fail, how is it going to fail?
I tell you, the key thing about this book and the film is it's the absolute. There's a kind of film I can watch again and again and again, because I just love to see, you know, heists. I love seeing plans.
Yep.
I love to be reminded of plans. I think it's a very male thing, actually.
Oh, it is, the Italian job being one of the best examples.
Yes, absolutely.
So satisfying.
Yes, it is. And, you know, everybody can remember, you know, if you go into Somerset House nowadays, you know, which is the kind of art gallery and so forth, you know. But in those days, it was the public records office, wasn't it? And so, you know, how do you get a passport? Well, you go and find the death records, you know, of somebody who died young, and then you submit you order up a birth certificate and so forth. That's how you do it. All those little things were things that we all learned from Day of the Jackal.
Completely.
We all learned that in those days, French hotels used to have to lodge the passports of people staying from overseas with the police overnight, didn't they?
That's right.
That's how he gets rumbled in the end, you know. All those little things we learned about the world.
It's the age before the internet, and they're trying to find out where this guy is, you know. And now, of course, you'd immediately have every record of every...
Well, you'd have his phone records.
You know, absolutely, you know, cell phones, whatever, you could track them. But it's just, it's riveting. Also, James Fox is, I think he's fantastic at it.
Oh, he's brilliant.
Because he's really charming. And he appears to have some kind of external warmth, and yet he is the most sinister character.
Yes.
If I remember rightly, he murders four people.
who get in his way. One is a guy who's forging papers for him, forging a passport for him.
Oh, yes, of the course. Old, as
the army veteran.
Yeah.
And then tries to blackmail him. And he just knocks him out and locks him in one of his own chests in his room and leaves him to die. He murders the woman that he has the affair with. Do you remember that?
You're spoiling this for people who haven't
seen it. Oh, God. No. So, well, I also murders the guy he meets in the Turkish bath, which is absolutely when he's masquerading as Per Lundquist.
Yeah, but he does.
Fantastic.
He's fantastic. And nobody in the history of movies has worn a cravat with quite such, you know,
aplomb
as James Fox does in Day of the Jackal. So that's our hot media tip, you know.
Rescue. We should mention the rescue too. Oh,
the rescue.
God,
we should mention for anybody who's Disney Plus to see the Beatles Get Back, and I'm sure there'll be many of them. The rescue is on Disney Plus, isn't it? Which is it's a very straight documentary made about an incident that occurred about
2018.
Oh, okay.
It flooded. Everyone will remember it. It's the time that the football team of small children, the 12 kids and their coach, were marooned in a flooded underwater cave system in Thailand. And it's about the three British divers who come in and find them. My God, there's tension for you. I mean, just to say, you know, everyone's got this thing about potholing. You either kind of really like potholing, a very, very small minority, or you're absolutely terrified by the idea of being trapped underground. Well, this is worse because it's potholing, but underwater. And as a scuba or sorry, ex-scuba diver, I can tell you that the psychological difference between diving in open water and, you know, if something went wrong, you could
go up,
spin your way to the surface and you might be fine. To diving with solid rock above you is incredibly destabilizing. And these guys are diving not only through solid rock. The children, in fact, are about one and a half miles from the entrance.
Unbelievable.
So think of a point 1.5 miles away and imagine you've got to get to it by swimming underwater in water they describe as chocolatey brown. They can't even see, on some occasions, their own hands. And they're swimming through this water. And one of them gets trapped on the way back, runs out of air and doesn't survive, one of the army SEALs, you know, to find these kids. And the moment when they're, and we've seen that bit of footage on the news, but the bit when they surface in the cave and they're aware from the scent in the air and from the noises that there are human beings in this cave, it's fantastic.
It's unbelievable. It's
really, really, really recommended. Thrilling.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
All right, we're joined by our birthday guest, Patreon supporter Paul Knox. Hello, Paul. Where are you?
I'm in Hong Kong. I'm in a hotel room in quarantine. So
this is a first.
It's a first. We've never had that before. Yeah. How long? So you came back from the UK, didn't you? And you're required to spend, was it 3 weeks in a hotel room?
3 weeks in a hotel room, 3 weeks in quarantine. So the only people I really have interaction with are the testers who come around to see me every 2 days and give me the swabs. And other than that, everything is left outside my door very efficiently. The rest of the time I'm in solitary, as they say.
So apart from you, you're working during the week, but you've been re-experiencing the Beatles Get Back, haven't you? Tell us about this.
Yep. Yeah, no, I've been doing the thing of watching. I watched it when it all came out first time round. And I've been watching it on a day-by-day basis, as you know, from the 2nd of January, whenever they first assembled in, and watching that slot for the day. So today was a dead slot because it was the day they were moving into Savile Row, and I think they dismantled Twickenham yesterday, and today was the day. I think they moved to Savile Row and suddenly realised that whatever Magic Alice had ruffled up wasn't going to be good enough, and the SOS had gone out to George Martin. So I think it starts again tomorrow.
Well, it's funny because George Martin is no longer working for Abbey Road, is he? He's working as an independent. And so they have to call Abbey Road.
Oh, yes.
And send their engineers round.
That's the thing. Sorted.
Yeah, that's
absolutely.
Right. Yeah. So all these...
Paul, are you listening to the I Am the Egg Pod podcast? Because they're
I am. Yes, and they're brilliant. Yeah.
Oh, they're the one I recommend to anybody listening is Day 5, Andy Miller, who comes up with amazing theories. And one of his best theories, I think, is that Lindsay Hogg didn't make a film about the Beatles' unhappiness. He made a film about his own unhappiness that the Beatles wouldn't collaborate on his elaborate idea for a film and then took it out on them with this negative edit, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, one of my questions was around it, which is, what film was Michael Lindsay-Hogg actually making? Because if it was a documentary, why is he in front of the camera so much? I mean, I've never seen a fly on the wall documentary where the director is so much present in front of the camera. And the last day I watched was the day when it was, you know, and then there were two sessions. And that was Michael Lindsay-Hogg sitting with, I think, Neil Aspinall and Paul and Ringo and Linda and whoever else was there. And I thought, why was the director sitting there in front of the camera? And what was he actually thinking he was doing?
I don't think he was expecting to be in it at all. It was a TV film at that point, wasn't it, that they were starting to make it? So there was certainly no question of him being in it. But the difference was they were shooting everything all the time because they had no expense spared. So it just naturally picked up all the things that wouldn't go anywhere near the film.
And, the reason that he's in there, I think a lot of the time, is that he is actually trying to negotiate with them about how the film should end. He has no sympathy at all for what they're going through. All he wants is the assurance that they're going to go to Tunisia or whatever.
He wants Tunisia. That's what he wants.
I haven't got a film.
He wants torchlight. He wants a Roman amphitheatre. Yeah. Like every film director wants a Roman amphitheatre. That's what he wants.
But I can see that. But I still find it strange that he did all of that in front of the camera, knowing that it was running.
I don't think there's any thought
that it would ever be shown at all. You know, they're so relaxed off camera. You know, it's just they were in charge of it. So Oh, well, I'm glad you. I'm glad you're still getting value out of it.
A couple of other quick thoughts on that. What one is a very trite point, because I think you mentioned the Beatles' thinness, and particularly John Lennon's thinness. I think it was you, David.
Yeah, I did.
But the bit I really noticed that, and which I really loved, was when, because it was the first time I'd ever seen a Beatle dancing. It was when George presents I, Me, Mine. And first of all, John and Yoko.
John and Yoko waltz, don't they?
And then John does this very strange flamenco dance, but he does it absolutely brilliantly. And, you know, because you only ever saw John Lennon or any of the Beatles on stage behind a guitar. And I think John Lennon used to sort of bounce a bit and foot tap, and that was the only thing. But I haven't seen anybody else mention the Beatles dancing. And I think there's another clip later where Paul and John are dancing to something.
Yes, they do. They kind of
dance together.
Actually, there is a famous sequence of the Beatles dancing because in a Hard Day's Night,
Ringo.
They go to a disco. Yeah. And Ringo particularly, I think all of them actually, but I think Ringo particularly was always the guy doing the mashed potato or whatever. He was always the first guy out on the dance floor, flinging himself around. So it was not, in that sense, it was not completely unprecedented. But you know, it's interesting. Yeah. It's just amazing the value people keep getting out, get back. It's absolutely astonishing.
Well, I think it will go on forever. I think somebody else commented about how it will be used sort of for business training because they're showing the creative processes.
Yes.
But I think I've also got this sort of nightmare feel that it will be used for sort of guidance training sessions or, you know, group therapy and people sort of saying, well, what do you know? How do you think George is feeling now? And how could Paul have handled that better?
Yes. How could he have handled that better? How can he achieve what he wants to achieve? His goal is to get them to play a certain way on the arrangement. Yeah. What's how he does it? Is it right or wrong?
Yeah, exactly.
That's very funny. Yeah. That's a brilliant idea.
Paul, I've got to ask you this question because I flung this question to the Massive last night. People talking about gig prices. Now that gigs are coming back on stream, people are complaining about how much they cost. I think the case in point was Elvis Costello's tour. I think it was 90 quid or whatever for certain tickets. Yeah. And people saying this is a bit much. And so I said, you know, what's the most you've ever paid? And how much would you pay to see who and where? And I got various responses in front of me. Neil Christie say he paid £180, which is a ticket price, not a town. Z Van Morrison at a tiny club called Subterranea in Ladbroke Grove a few years ago. And he says it was well worth it. Duncan says he spent £60 to see the Stones at Hyde Park.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mark, and the price seemed irrelevant as most folks around us talked all the whole way through the set or took endless selfies. James Wilkinson, talking about Elvis Costello, he says he can't justify the price, because he likes him, but his wife isn't that much of a fan. You see, and I think this is a really interesting part of the argument, you know, because you're paying for two very often, and one person is keener than the other one. Michael McHugh says £100 to see Roger Waters play Dark Side of the Moon in sequence, plus a big selection of his own stuff, and he thought that was worth every cent. What's the most you've ever paid, Paul? Can you remember?
It's one of two. One was I saw Brian Wilson at the outdoor venue in Los Angeles.
The Hollywood Bowl, right?
It was the other one. It's called not the Olympic Bowl. I can't remember. It will come back to me. But it was...
Candlestick Park?
That's San Francisco. Oh, yeah. There's another, but it's a great venue. And I paid, but it involved a meet and greet with himself, Al Jardine, and Blondie Chaplin, as he called. It also allowed me to go and see some of the warm up, or they call it the warm up, the sound check.
All right.
And actually, that was, I can't remember if I paid $500 for it or something, but it was a fantastic. I mean, it was a beautiful California night. It was a fantastic concert and worth every penny. I think I also paid $400 for tickets to see the Rolling Stones at Hyde Park in the sort of enclosed area at the front. And again, it was that was the first time I'd ever seen the Stones. I thought it was probably going to be a one-off, and again, enjoyed every moment of it.
Oh, right.
But there's an element with those old school acts, isn't there, that this might be your last chance to see them. So they've got, you know, and people are taking on along their children because they want you to be able to see your grandchildren. You saw Keith Richards or whatever. So that's part of it.
Exactly. So I think those are the two I've paid most for.
The other factor there in the case of the first one is you're in California. Yeah. Therefore, if you're a summer evening, the weather's going to be fine. Yeah. That's going to make a huge difference, isn't it? Yeah. Whereas over here, it's a complete lottery.
Lottery going to Hyde Park, Adele.
It could be absolutely terrible. So, who would you pay most to see, Paul? Have you thought about that? Or have you ticked off all the ones?
I've ticked off most of the ones I would want to see. I think just because he's so unique, and actually Chris Heath was reminding me about him when he did the session with him, Jonathan Richman, I saw him in Los Angeles on the same thing, and he is so unique live that if I wasn't able to get a ticket through the normal routes, I would pay way over the odds to see him, because he only plays small venues and he's so unique. Don't immediately come to mind, but I have seen most of the people I really want to see.
Right, fair enough. So what were you wanted to ask us about Elvis Presley?
Yeah, so just by way of brief background, this book, Leaving the Building, which Eamon Ford. I heard about because Eamon Ford sort of talked about it on one of your podcasts, and it slightly overlaps with what I do in my professional career, which is helping people sort of think about their estates. And so I've been writing, I've written a review of the book, but it was the Elvis story in there from the business side that intrigued me. But since then, I've been sort of getting quite intrigued by Elvis himself again. And as somebody who was sort of brought up with the post-60 Elvis more than the pre-army Elvis, and always quite liked him and sort of had all the compilation albums, I've always known a bit about him without being a huge fan. But this has sort of got me into, I watched his comeback special, which I thought was absolutely a tremendous concert. But I just wonder, you know, I've never heard the two of you talk about Elvis and how you evaluate purely his musical legacy, his musical output, and whether, you know, other than the obvious type, you know, the greatest hits type tracks, whether you have favorite Elvis albums, tracks,
My personal favorite is probably the phase of Elvis's career that I think is referred to in some quarters as Velvet Elvis, which is kind of, it's the early 70s. It's when he went back to Memphis and made, well, what became called the Memphis album, didn't they? Mm. And I think the one I like most from that era, oh, it's a song called Long Black Limousine. Do you know that?
I don't know that, no.
Which is about somebody dreaming about, you know, coming back to their town in a long black limousine. And of course, the twist is they come back in a long black limousine because they're dead.
Oh. Very good.
It's absolutely fantastic.
That's fantastic.
You know, that stuff is the stuff that I probably play more than anything else. It's very odd because Elvis Presley seems to have sort of slightly gone off the radar in the last 5 years. That's my feeling. Whereas somebody like the Beatles seem absolutely pin sharp right now. Whereas somebody like Elvis just seems to have drifted away. But then again, there's been times in the past when he drifted away and he drifted back one way or another. You know,
there's often one particular period of Elvis that's in focus, isn't there? You know, suddenly it's the very early phase that becomes fashionable, or it's the early 70s phase.
Yeah.
The bit that never becomes fashionable is when the rhinestones start to appear and he goes to Las Vegas and stuff.
Yeah. But there's a biopic coming out this year, which Baz Luhrmann has made, with Tom Hanks playing Colonel Tom Parker.
And is there really?
In June. So I wonder if that will put Elvis back in the spotlight.
It may well do, this is what tends to happen with kind of rock legacies, that, you know, they drift off and they come back in again. So you've been writing a review of Eamon's book for a learned journal read by people who plan estates. Eamon will be thrilled to know that.
So delighted.
No, it's okay. I've spoken to him, funnily enough.
All right.
I've sent him a copy of the review, but I've got to do another article based on his book in the next 2 weeks, which is really not totally based on his book, but just really the going into the whole concept of how difficult it is to plan legacies.
Yeah.
And I have found the Elvis story, you know, really intriguing to get back into. And I know any books, because there's so much written about him. A lot of it is quite salacious, or else it's sort of the mainstream books.
Well, the two best books, I think, are the Peter Guralnik books, whatever they're called.
Yeah.
Part of his career, second part of his career. They're fantastic books. And Peter Guralnik knows the music and knows Memphis and New Elvis and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd recommend. So it's your birthday. Have you actually had it?
Yeah, no, that was yesterday, yes.
All right, okay. Yes. How was that? So birthday in quarantine.
Yes. Birthday in quarantine.
How does one celebrate your birthday when you're on your own in quarantine, in isolation?
Well, Zoom calls and birthday cakes and everything. It all happened, so it was fine.
Good. All right. He celebrated it, and he's got a running machine, listeners, in his room. So he'll be pounding up and down of an evening. Paul, it's been lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, lovely to talk to you both.
Great to talk
to you. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks for the tips on Elvis as well.
Okay, and have a good rest of your time in quarantine.
Yeah, thank you very much. Lovely to
speak. Bye. Happy birthday.
Bye.
Thank you, bye.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
So, right, any other business? We're joined by Alex Gold. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm well. How are you guys?
We're in very good shape. Dave Hepworth, as you know, is never a man without a theory. And we were talking yesterday, and Dave, you had an absolute corker.
I think you should advance this to the nation because I absolutely love this and think it's genuinely watertight. Tell us what your theory is.
Well, I was thinking, as I do think regularly, about what happened to the Beatles in late 1966. And as everybody recalls, they stopped touring, didn't they? They played the last show at Candlestick Park in San Francisco in the summer. And then they took about 6 weeks off, I think, before they reconvened at Abbey Road. And when they reconvened, they had all grown mustaches, yep. Hadn't they not?
Facial hair, yes.
They had short hair and they all had mustaches. And let us assume that there was not a memo going around the group saying, when you return to Abbey Road, could you please make sure you've grown a mustache? No, they had just all done it. But this marked the beginning of their transition from their live years to their studio years. It marked the transition from their kind of teenage years to their adult years. You know, it marked their transition from pop star to rock star, if you like. And it struck me that the unspoken message of a pop star growing facial hair is, please, please don't scream at me.
But you were making the point that people probably didn't scream at people who had. I mean, there are various people who started off without beards, like Cat Stevens, and were screamed at, and possibly still screamed a little at after they had grown beards. But broadly, there's a change, isn't there? There's the Jim Morrison without a beard, and there's the Jim Morrison with a beard. You send out the message that you are a serious artist. You possibly sit down to play. I don't know. These things are possible, aren't they?
I don't think, you know, there are major screams. I don't think they ever elicit major screams once they've got beards or facial hair. You cannot scream seriously at groups who have beards or facial hair. I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen. This is now I know Alex Gold is going to come along and say, well,
the Kings of Leon.
Kings of Leon. I'm saying nobody seriously screamed at the Kings of Leon. Not compared to the Beatles or the Osmonds or the Jacks.
What you said to me, Dave, was it? Can you not tell the difference between a scream and a stifled squeak? Yes.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. You know, you very often, you know, you'll get gigs where there'll be somebody, I don't know, Liam Gallagher or whatever, and he might have facial hair. And there might be a bunch of women in their 20s or 30s or even their 40s, you know, squeaking, you know, satirically.
It made me remember.
That is not.
Yeah, yeah.
That is not like the sound of 13, 14, 15-year-old girls screaming, because that is a totally different thing. And I put it to you, Alex Gold, that nobody screams seriously at musicians with beards and facial hair. And I'm looking at you, Alex Gold, with your beard and your facial hair.
I was about to say that I grew mine for precisely that reason. It was just getting out of hand, frankly.
And, there you go.
Go to the corner shop and get a pint of milk without being mobbed.
Exactly. There you go. There you go.
I remember having a very funny conversation with John Savage, the music critic, in the Mojo office once, and he was talking. He's very pop music, John's, you know. And at that stage of his life, I wonder if it's still true, he hated the band. And I said, what is it the band you don't like? He said, you can hear the beards. I thought that was great. What it meant was everything that comes with the idea of beards. Do you know what I mean?
That's kind of true. There are two types of music in this world. There is beard music and there is chin music.
This is
suede. Yeah. Suede is chin music. The band is beard music.
Right.
For example.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Now, talking of while we're talking about classifications and so forth, I was intrigued. I was looking at a thing online. What's your favourite dad band says about you? And I wanted to take advantage of this opportunity to discuss the subject of dad rock, because I'm never entirely clear what it is. This is a list. This is from an American publication, from McSweeney's. This is their list of dad rock groups. The War on Drugs, The National, Wilco, Pavement, Pearl Jam, Bright Eyes, Father John Misty, Arcade Fire, Bon Iver, Modest Mouse, My Morning Jacket, Pixies, Everclear,
Counting Crows, yeah,
yes, Death Cab for Cutie, The Mountain Goats, Counting Crows, REM. So those are American ones. What do you understand by dad rock, Alex Gold? Who are the English proponents of it?
I suppose I'd define it as slightly sort of lump and plodding guitar-based sounds, mainly probably made by four men, maybe five.
But also mainly with a male audience, don't you think?
Yeah, so an audience that looks like a lot of thumbs.
Because I think a really good example is Happy like Mondays. Do you think? Yeah, it's good. UK, I think the Happy Mondays is a good example.
Ocean Colour Scene, our peak.
Yes, dad. Ocean Colour Scene, brilliant. That's very good.
Most things Weller related. Anything that kind of...
The Jam, completely.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, 100%. Oasis would fall under that banner, no doubt.
So you can't have dad rock if there's a kind of electronic keyboard.
Hot Chip, for example, are not dad rock.
Depeche Mode are not dad rock, are they?
No, Depeche Mode are too sexy. Another thing. Dad rock is not sexy. You cannot be sexy and play dad rock. It's
there you go. This good. Is what we want.
This is very good.
This is these are the sweeping statements people look to us for.
Yeah, for example, Personal Jesus, sexy tune.
Yes, definitely.
The Day I Caught the Train, not sexy.
Very good. Well, if anybody's got anything further to contribute to that that burning debate, we'd love to hear from you.
I think it's groups that people tend to look at support, like football teams. Do you think there's an element of that too?
Yeah,
Chris Heath, who we interviewed for The Word in Your Attic a couple of days ago, wrote a brilliant piece for Q magazine in about 1988 about travelling with a bunch of Happy Mondays fans from Victoria Station on a coach to Paris to see them play. Fantastic. And it was just like that. You know, it was just a sort of football experience. You know, you're going to an away match and expecting them to lose, which they did. And I think that kind of, it's a very male thing. And that's one of the main things about dad rock, I think.
Yeah. I've got some readers' correspondence in front of me here. Adam Burry says, have you ever had a record that works as well on 45 as it does on 33?
That's good.
He says he's just bought the fantastic new covers EP from Bridget May Power on vinyl. Yeah. They put it on at 33, not realizing it was meant to be played at 45, and sounded like Anthony and the Johnsons. Still very rewarding. I have one, actually, Adam, that I can propose here. And I can no longer do it myself because I haven't got a 45 RPM copy of Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town by Kenny Rogers and the First Edition, which some of you may remember. Really good record.
Because it has such a deep register vocal, doesn't it?
And if you play that at 33, like my flatmate used to play it at 33 in 1970, it sounds like the bluesiest, swampiest, lightning slim record you've ever heard in your life. It just absolutely perfect when it goes down from 45 to 33. So I'm having said that, I'm going to make efforts now to see if I can buy a copy of 45 of that record on Discogs or whatever, and I'll play it to you to demonstrate when I've done that. Edward Gay wants to know what we think about Jeremy Spencer out of Fleetwood Mac. He says he didn't get the his contributions as a songwriter and vocalist seem to be woefully overlooked in the Fleetwood Mac story. His contributions on early albums seem purely limited to bottlenecks.
Is he still with us, Jeremy Spencer?
Yes, he is.
He is, because he disappeared, didn't he, and joined a religious cult?
Well, he did, and in 1971, I think.
Yeah.
He walked out on Fleetwood Mac in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And joined the Children of God and didn't come back, really. But, yeah, he's still around. And the fascinating tale, because Mark and I are old enough to remember Fleetwood Mac, the rugby shirt years, which was when Fleetwood Mac first came to prominence. They were a kind of rave up rock and roll band, weren't they? All used to wear striped rugby shirts. And Jeremy Spencer was the chief lad and kind of show-off, wasn't he, in the group? Was. Didn't he used to sport a prosthetic penis and things like that? He did all these kind of
I can't believe I've forgotten it if he did, but yes.
He did. He used to also dress up as a kind of rocker, grease his hair back, didn't he? Because the B-side of one of Fleetwood Mac's singles is credited to, I'm just dredging this from the back of my memory here. Credited to Earl Vincent and the Valiants. And it's called, Alex, close your ears. It's called Somebody's Gonna Get Their Head Kicked In Tonight. And that was is Alex the younger generation so easily shocked?
By gosh.
That was the knockabout humor of 1970 or whatever it was.
Wasn't
it? Anyway, the leader of that was Jeremy Spencer. He was always out on that flank of Fleetwood Mac. So he was probably the last person anybody was expecting to wander off and join the children,
exactly, become a children kind of God child,
and never come back. But no, I remember him with Fleetwood Mac with great affection.
Yeah.
We have to tell the story about the Pope has gone record shopping.
This is a great story because the Pope. There's a picture of him coming out of a record store in Rome. You know, and there's a little comment where he says, "Oh, he was spotted by a journalist, or whatever." And I suppose the journalist just kind of doing his job to report that I was there. But the interesting pop fact is the Pope is dressed in full papal.
The Pope. How did anybody recognise him?
I mean, part of the fact he hasn't told where he is working. I don't know, mitre and carrying an orb and sceptre or whatever else is missing. I don't really know, but he is dressed as the Pope. So unless the streets of Rome are full of people dressed as the Pope, which I don't know, he apparently
gets around the Eternal City in a small Fiat, rather than a Pope mobile. So you know, one of the millions of indistinguishable Fiats pulls up at the curb, and out gets the Holy Father.
Yeah,
goes into a small record shop.
Run by Kelsey.
So you're reading A Cellar Full of Noise, Mark.
I am. Oh, my Lord. That's an amazing book, isn't it? They've republished it. This is Brian Epstein's autobiography that came out, written with Derek Taylor, actually. It came out in 1964, I think, didn't it?
And, probably.
It's absolutely fantastic. It's just been republished with an interview by Craig Brown, a very, very good one. What an extraordinary story that is. Just, you know, it's astonishing, among many astonishing things, is the fact that he doesn't, at no point does he declare, obviously, his sexuality. But it's brilliantly hinted at. He talks about being in the army, doesn't he? I'm the worst soldier imaginable, and how absolutely ineffectual he is. But it's very, very touching. And also, you're interested in the fact that he's theatre, that he's, you know, RADA and his whole theatrical kind of background, that he understands that what makes the show Beers and the stagecraft element of the Beatles that makes them successful. But it also struck me that it's his sexual orientation, actually, that's immensely useful in the way that he sees the Beatles entirely from the point of view of what was their main constituent audience in the early days, which is teenage girls.
He understands
the dynamic of what makes
through the eye of desire, isn't it?
Yeah, you know? It is.
that's the way he does it.
Yeah.
And which is something he had in common with a huge amount of managers of very successful managers of pop groups down the years. So it's republished.
I thought it was absolutely riveting, and it's interesting also that he wrote it so young, because he's recording is something that he has never happened before, that level of pandemonium. And it's about them being imprisoned in hotels, and it's about fame, and it's about adulation and celebrity, you know. And A, it's never really happened before, but B, he obviously doesn't expect it to last. It's 1964. This cannot last. And there's a lovely element of revenge about it too. And he talks about Dick Rowe at Decca. Now, he reiterates everything that Dick Rowe had said about guitar groups and how the Beatles will never catch on. And, you know, it's so interesting. Really good book.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.